Now, in Sierra Leone, up in the bulge of Northwest Africa, prosperity is measured in rice. Why, they even have a saying, if you haven't eaten rice today, you haven't eaten. But in one part of the country, rice is being replaced by sugarcane. Now, Africans won't be eating this sugarcane. Foreign industries are going to consume it. It's going to be converted to ethanol. There's big money in biofuel. But any chance big land deals might hurt Sierra Leone's ability to feed itself as it continues to recover from an 11-year civil war? Well, not to worry. It's all been arranged, apparently, even if there are some questions as to how, as we hear from Canadian journalist Joan Baxter.
We are now on harvesting. We are harvesting our rice now. We are trying to dry them. We bag them. We put it here.
You have two locks on this door. Are you afraid of thieves?
Yes, we are. That is true. If you have rice, you make millions.
Teresa Cargbo is taking me into the community store. It's a small, low-slung mud structure where farmers store their rice after harvest. She works for a church-funded farmers group, trying to help farmers get back to the good old days of food security. She's a slim, deceptively delicate woman in her late 40s, with short-cropped hair and serious eyes, except when her face opens up in a wide smile. With her college degree in agriculture, she has an independent mind and a rare willingness to express it. She shows the farmers how to multiply and produce their own seeds so their farms provide them nearly everything they need. And that bounty is evident here in the community rice store.
We are now in the store. We have come here to look at the rice that has been grown by our farmers.
So this is all organic rice that I'm seeing in here. Yes. The highest quality, no pesticides, no chemicals.
No pesticide, no chemical. That is true.
The village is Yenkasa. Like most small farming communities here, Yenkasa has no electricity or modern amenities of any kind. I'm watching dinner being prepared here, and it smells very good. Water is carried by hand from wells. Kitchens are outside. And washing up is done in large basins right on the ground.
Rice bread.
This bread? Rice bread. People here measure their well-being by how many cups of rice they can afford to eat each day. And since folks here grow their own, they're at least better off than people in the cities. They were hard hit when food prices went sky high a couple of years ago. That happened because of speculation and a global rush to grow crops for biofuels like ethanol instead of food. Teresa takes me for a walk over the hills to a nearby village, Lungi Acre. In front of the primary school, there's a football match going on.
Yes, there's a football match going on.
This is the actual place, Lungi Acre, which will be the headquarters of everything?
Yes, it is.
So this community, will it be moved or it will stay here?
It will be moved.
The villages of Yenkasa and Lungi Acre, and a couple of dozen others, are about to become part of the wealthy world's rush for agrofuel. This entire area, 40,000 hectares, that's 40 kilometers by 10 kilometers, is to be transformed into a giant sugarcane plantation and industrial factory producing ethanol for export to Europe. Andrew Touré is project manager for Addex Bioenergy, the company behind the scheme.
I call that an investment in agriculture because we are really doing with both agriculture and industry that we are creating. If it works right, others will follow the examples.
Addex Bioenergy is privately owned by Jean-Claude Gandour, a multi-billionaire who appears each year on the Forbes list of the world's wealthiest people. Andrew Touré seems convinced that this venture will bring money to the people in this area too.
Plus the employment of opportunities that we create. We are not taking agricultural land from them, land that they're using to grow their crops. We are looking at marginal lands that they will never be used for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years because they are degraded lands.
People will end up being resettled to make room for all of this, but it's not clear how many people or how they'll be compensated, if at all. The company's own environmental impact assessment says that there are threats to local rivers and that pesticides, herbicides, and fertilizers will run off into the lowland areas, though Addix says that local people will still be able to farm their own rice in some areas around the sugarcane. But in Andrew Touré's view, what people have been doing here up to now isn't real agriculture anyway.
When you have 70% of your population in agriculture, shows you that it is not agriculture they're practicing, it's a way of living, because they don't have other things to do. Okay, what we want to do is create more efficient methods of producing using highly skilled technicians and reduce that population that is in agriculture that can do other things other than just farming. And we've been very transparent. We've not hidden everything from anybody, and the communities are satisfied with what we're doing.
At least the government is satisfied.
We try to make informed decisions, but then at the end of the day, one of the things that us developing countries have had to learn is that you've got to respect market forces to the best of your ability.
So Olunyi Robin Coker is the private sector advisor to the president of Sierra Leone. He works out of State House, where he meets with me in an echoing conference room.
Sierra Leone today enjoys a situation where there's about 5 million hectares of arable land. For our food security needs, we believe we need less than 30% of that land. Okay, so there's 2.5 million hectares still available for us to do cash crops, biofuels, whatever it is that we think helps to balance out the needs of the economy.
The Addix project is being partly financed by 7 European Development Banks, as well as the African Development Bank. The first phase alone will cost $300 million. Robin Coker claims that this kind of investment will bring revenue to the country. But I'm curious how much. So I ask him whether Addix Bioenergy is getting any special concessions, a tax holiday maybe.
Addix are entitled to the same incentives that any other investor would be entitled to in Sierra Leone. There's no reason for us to make an exception at this stage.
I don't know what that means.
It means that Addix will get the incentives that are available to other agricultural investors.
So they will get a corporate tax holiday.
Addix will get the same incentives that every other investor will get.
Sierra Leone's government likes to boast it is one of the most business-friendly nations in Africa. The Sierra Leone Investment and Export Promotion Agency, an agency set up by an arm of the World Bank, sells the country's assets to the world. Its website confirms there's a very generous tax holiday for agricultural investors of 10 years.
Well, it's not like the investors are going to grab their land or take it from them.
Raymond Kai Becky is head of investment promotion at the investment agency. We have a lively discussion in his air-conditioned and ultra-modern office in the capital, Freetown.
Let's take, for example, if Addix establishes in this country, we're talking about six thousand employees, and you know
their environmental impact assessment study says 2,200 permanent jobs. I beg to differ.
No problem. You're fine. But what I'm looking at the ripple effect. You're looking at 2,200. If I am working here, it's like 7 of my family members are working here. So my salary is shared among 7 other people.
To date, Addix has employed only 50 local men to work on its sugarcane nursery. And they're being paid just 10,000 leones. That's about $2.50 a day. Can that wage really sustain 7 people?
Well, it's a relative term. If you're making 10,000 a day, you are rich because you have loads of people who are not making 1,000 a day.
Yeah, but they're feeding themselves on their farms.
Well, thank you for pushing me to the world. But actually, that's the story as a country we want to change.
This is another farm.
What are they growing here?
Chili pepper.
This is a big chili pepper farm. A lot of hot peppers here.
Yes. We eat a lot of chili pepper.
Back in Lungi Acre, Teresa Kargbo shows me another farm in the Addix lease area.
Where will this woman go with her chili pepper farm when the sugar cane is growing here?
Well, I don't know, really. They will not be permitted to farm in this area. They would have been located to other villages.
So we've just come upon another farm, and there's a woman in here working. So what's she planting here?
Cassava.
And what's her name?
Adama Kanu.
Does she know that maybe in the next 2 years this will all be leased out to other people, that she'll have to find a new place?
She didn't know.
Adama Kanu tells us that the crops she plants here feed her three children and also bring in enough money to pay for their school fees. Her husband is paralyzed, so she keeps the family going. Teresa Kargbo says that for all the addicts' talk of consulting with the locals, many of these people still don't really know what's coming. They worry about speaking out against it, and so does Teresa. Fearful of putting her job at risk, she asked me not to use her real name in this story. After all, jobs are in short supply around here.
The young boys, they want employment. Honestly, whatever it costs them, they want it. But the older people are very wise and they are worried now, especially the elder of this village. He's worried like hell.
Yes, very concerned.
I find the village elder, 90-year-old Pa Alimami Koroma, studying the Quran on the front porch of his small mud house, where he speaks to me through a translator. I want to know if he's concerned about the loss of the farmland.
We will not let them take all the land. We will tell them to leave part of the land for our own use.
And do you know what agreements they have written down?
They have written and we have signed for the land, for the release of the land.
But you don't know how much land that you signed for?
After they have surveyed, they have not reported how many acres we have given to them.
Pa Alimami Koroma says that the only reason he agreed to the project is because he was converted by a man he calls his son, the MP for the area, the Honorable Martin Bangura. I meet with him in the nearby town of Makeni, in the luxury hotel owned by one of the partners in the sugarcane and ethanol project, Sierra Leonean mogul Vincent Kanu. It was Kanu who invited Martin Bangura to sign on to the ADEX project.
So after that, I started visiting communities. Some villages, I went there, I slept there for 2-3 days. And some were very happy, some were skeptical because of certain reasons.
Martin Bangura is a dapper man, dressed in well-pressed shirt and trousers. He grew up in this area, but his success as an MP has given him considerable influence over his less flashy constituents. He declares himself the champion of ADEX Bioenergy.
Yes. I'm the champion. I take myself to be the champion. The president arranged a dinner with the bankers. So the managing director informed the president and the bankers that if we are to succeed in this project or on this project, then the Honorable Martin is the champion of it.
Bangura and ADEX insist that they are being completely transparent about the project. But what about ADEX's promise that local people will be allowed to grow rice in the lowland areas around the sugarcane, and what it says in the environmental impact assessment about pesticide contamination? You, Honorable Bangura, would you like to live in a village and be trying to grow rice in a place where they're dumping pesticide on your head?
No. Those things came up. The people, the people are very, our people are, they are just villagers, but they are sometimes very intelligent. And that is why we have, ADEX has decided to have to put boxes, suggestion boxes, so that people can give their comment, concerns, suggestion.
I don't see any logic in that box. I mean, 90% of people are illiterate. They will come to me and ask, why are they putting that box there? For what reason? When I saw the box there, I said, well, this is crazy. I don't know.
Teresa Cardwell has seen the suggestion box already. I go looking for it. I find it eventually, sitting all by itself on a veranda of a mud hut in Yenkasa, locked, unlabeled, and clearly unused. No one around even knows what it's doing there. For Dispatches, I'm Joan Baxter in Yenkasa, Sierra Leone.
And I'm Rick McInnes-Ray in Canada. And Joan just brought us one case of land in transition. But for a more global picture, I'm joined from Montreal by Devlin Kuyak. He's a researcher with the nonprofit organization known as GRAIN. That stands for Genetic Resources Action International. It's concerned with sustainable food projects. Devlin, welcome to Dispatches.
Thank you, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You know, the documentary we've just heard focuses on one particular deal in Sierra Leone. In your view, is it a land grab or just smart development?
Well, for us, this is one land grab. That's part of a larger trend. I think it's important to always not look at these cases in isolation. There's a major new phenomenon now happening across the planet. In our estimations, there's well over 40 million hectares that are being negotiated. These land grabs are very large on a scale of typically over 10,000 hectares, which is something, of course, new. There's, in our estimations, about $100 billion that are already that is already on the table, already being mobilized for the acquisition of land in other countries to produce food, mainly for export. And that's why we're calling it a global land grab.
Well, if governments, though, like Sierra Leone's are on side, and in its case, the World Bank is on side, European investors and the African Development Bank are on side, how can this be a bad thing?
Well, I think it's goes back to the motivation. I mean, you have to remember that this is growing out of a food crisis. Currently, we have over a billion people on the planet who don't have access to food. It's also growing out of the financial crisis. So investors looking for a safe haven for their investments, looking at a place where they can get returns. And they think that they can make it in food because the long-term prognosis is of increasing food needs and more difficulty in producing it. So they see profits there.
So what kind of crops are you seeing them wanting to grow?
Well, in this case, I think it was about biofuel production. But in many cases now, it's about staple foods that they're producing, either for export to the international market or for specific markets. For instance, in the case of Saudi Arabia looking to outsource food production in Pakistan, that production will be specifically for the Saudi Arabian market. And this is new as well. We're not talking about coffee and mangoes here. We're talking about staple food production.
Yeah, you know, I was struck by the diversity of some of the players. The Gulf state of Qatar negotiating for acreage in Kenya, Sudan leasing thousands of hectares from South Korea for wheat, and China, of course, bidding for land rights in Zambia and the DR Congo to grow biofuels. There's even this rare Africa to Africa deal in the offing. Congo wants to lease food lands to South Africa. What is the common thread, do you think, that explains this diversity of the developers to you?
Well, I think there are two threads, really. On the one hand, you have certain states who are cash rich but food poor in the sense that they depend on imports. So that could be Japan, Korea, the Gulf states, China, even Libya, India. And these countries have food security concerns. And then you have the financial investors who have, again, as I say, are looking for a way to cash in on the rise in food prices. And they're looking at controlling farmland. And I think that's the basic motivation here.
You know, we heard in Joan's piece there that Addex Bioenergy contends much of the land it's using is currently underused or degraded anyway. So it's not like it's something the locals would want to hold on to. I don't know how common an argument that is, but what do you make of it?
Well, I think it's always put forward that it's underutilized land. But it depends on who you talk to. For instance, I was in Tanzania recently, and I spoke with the Investment Center, which is a promotion agency for foreign investment. And they'll tell you that there's lots of land available. But then I was speaking with the head of the farmers organization there, and he said there isn't an ounce of land in the country that's not being used. So it depends on who you talk with. If you talk with farmers, they'll tell you the land is important for water. It's been important for crop rotation. The forests, of course, the local communities depend on them. And in many cases, those are even exceptions. What's at stake here is the most productive land, because investors, of course, are drawn to the most productive land. And so there are communities, there are farmers who want to farm that land, and it's being given over to foreign investors.
I was surprised to hear ADAC's bioenergies man say it plans to be in Sierra Leone for 100 years. A long-range lease is like that a good thing in a land deal?
Well, that's what they're after. The magic number seems to be 99 years. Farmer leaders are saying, well, we have to think about what the situation of our country is going to be like three generations from now with climate change happening. In a country like Senegal, food production or the capacity for production is supposed to decline by 50%, so the demand for land is going to increase. So land which may seem to be somewhat available, those are going to be sought after lands 10, 20 years down the road.
You know, it seems to come down to subsistence food farming versus factory product farming. One way the population can feed itself, the other way it could end up dependent on the wages of the factory and the largesse of the state to make up any shortfall. Is it the case that you don't trust the developers, the governments, to make good on their end of this sort of social compact?
Well, there's not much of a social compact to begin with. I mean, these contracts are usually one, two, three pages at most, and there's very little in there that offers any guarantees to the local population. Plus, farmers have been saying for decades now that what they need is just a policy environment from which to work within. They can look after the food needs of the local populations if they're not being subjected to competition from subsidized, dumped imports coming in periodically, if they have access to markets. The question here is about who is producing the food.
Well, by the same token, many of the companies promise higher economic development along with these investments. There'll be jobs for local people, investment in infrastructure, roads, even a deep seaport in the case of the Kenyan deal if it comes off. They say it'll just bring better, more efficient agriculture to these places. Is it possible to conclude how this kind of scenario, these promises, have worked out?
Well, there are very few cases that are on the ground and running currently. Most of the deals are still being negotiated or they haven't been put into operation yet. But in places where that's happened, for instance, in Ethiopia, where a large Indian corporation, Karuturi Global, has an investment there to produce maize and rice now for export, there were farmers farming teff, which is the local cereal crop. There were farmers using that land for pastoralism. The local communities were very dependent on this. And don't forget, Ethiopia is a country where almost half of the population is in a situation of hunger.
Sure.
And Karuturi is coming in there with large-scale machinery, on a large scale with high-tech machinery. And they're saying that they're going to produce jobs, that they're going to offer the government some revenue. Well, the land is being sold for less than a dollar. The wages that they're paying are below the minimum that the World Bank sets, which is at 70 cents a day. The conditions are quite deplorable. So the benefits that are there for the local people are very, very few, but the consequences are quite high.
Let's talk about the lessons of a project that seems to have gone sideways. One of the big deals recently was Madagascar. The South Korean Daewoo Company wanted to produce corn, palm oil. It would have been a vast deal, a million hectares and more, I think. But there were protests, there was violence, there was even a coup. Why did people react so strongly against it?
Well, half of the arable land of the country was at stake. It was a deal negotiated behind closed doors by a very corrupt government with one large Korean multinational corporation. There were direct consequences for the local people. And land, of course, is something so sacred in many of these countries. I'm sure Dispatches has covered many, many situations, many countries where the conflicts there are over land. And so I think it struck a real chord with the people, and there was an immediate reaction. And yes, the new government immediately declared that the deal had been squashed. And unfortunately, there are other deals in the offing in Madagascar.
Well, as you say, there is more deals in progress than in practice. So I don't want to make more of this than it is. But some people are calling it a kind of new form of agrarian colonialism, a second scramble for Africa. What do you think?
Well, I think it's a fairly accurate depiction. This is a massive expansion of corporate agriculture into the African continent. It's going to displace many people. It's going to have enormous environmental impacts. And the issue of land is, again, so fundamental in so many of these countries, and it's so important to development, to the end of poverty in Africa. And I think the reaction that's going to happen as well to this kind of investment is going to be equally as strong as the reaction that it was to colonialism.
But investors aren't stupid. Countries aren't stupid when they look for places to lease land overseas. They know they're taking a risk of their own with respect to uncertain stability or security in some post-war countries. But how much risk do you think they're adding if the local population feels like it's being pushed off its traditional land?
Well, I think that's a huge question. I think investors are very worried about the political risk that exists. I think many are getting a little bit nervous about the reaction that this is generating. And I think that's a good thing. I think there are more questions need to be raised. There needs to be more attention on what's happened. There needs to be more exposure of the deals that are being negotiated, often in secret right now.
I know there's been talk among the G8 countries of having some kind of a code of conduct to govern these deals. I got to think that's a bit like asking the foxes to make the rules for the hen house. But how do you see it? What are they talking about doing?
Well, they're, of course, only talking about voluntary codes or guidelines. There's nothing that would be obligatory. They also seem to be skewing the matter a bit because they'll start talking about outgrowing schemes and helping small farmers when, in fact, the investors are exclusively interested in large-scale investment and having full control over the land and what happens with that production. So it's impossible in our minds to imagine that there's going to be some kind of a win-win scenario that comes out of this. More important is that the international agencies begin to look more at what the fundamental problem here is, and that's the food crisis. That's the fact that we have enough food on the planet, and yet a billion people are starving.
So what do you do?
Well, you can invest in farmers because farmers are currently, they make up about 80% of that 1 billion people who are hungry. They have been, I think, at the losing end of the WTO, of the larger political context, of the policies that have been implemented over the last couple decades. And the food crisis really put that into perspective because those countries that were suffering the most were those who had let go of their agriculture, who had been told through structural adjustment programs and so forth to open the door to imports. And that they would be better off focusing on other things. And I think that's where we have to start from, is saying how can we revitalize the small-scale agriculture that exists in these countries?
Sounds like some tough questions ahead, Devlin. Thanks very much for throwing some light on some of them.
Thanks for having us.